Good morning. Good morning. How are you all? You all right? Good, good, good. That's an important question, isn't it? Especially if you live in England. I've discovered that's a very important question. And the longer I've spent in England, I came over to England from Northern Ireland. You've worked out I'm not from England, haven't you? You've worked out. I came over here in 1997, and I've gradually realized that that's a really important question. But it's a question you never actually answer honestly. It's just a kind of a getting out of the way question, isn't it, at the start of a conversation. How are you? Oh, great, fine, thanks, great, yes. Not. Or if you really want to be quintessentially English, you do the wonderful thing, because we never want to be bold or brash. We don't want to be too big. You know, like just like Northern Ireland, we like to cut down people that get too big a high opinion of themselves. And so even when we're talking to somebody and somebody introduces us and we say, how are you doing? We'll even make sure that that's a negative. We'll say, how are you? Not too bad. I'm not too bad. I'm not too bad. Sorry, I'm not sinning just right now as I'm speaking to you. I'm not too bad. I'm not too bad. Even in our articulation of that, we find a way of making it sort of somewhere in the middle. I'm all right. I'm somewhere in the middle. And I've discovered that I quite massively sometimes want to just step into that central zone of just being all right. We want people to think we're all right, don't we? We want people to think we're all right. We don't want people to think that we're, oh, I'm great, hi. Those people are annoying. But we also don't want to be a burden on people. We don't want people to think we're down here somewhere. Like, oh, how are you? Oh. We somehow, something in us doesn't want to be that sort of person. So we try to find ourselves in this kind of sometimes quite fake middle of being not too bad. The glorious thing about this psalm this morning is it is yet another example of David not wanting to be in that fake middle ground. Now, sometimes that is exactly where we are, which is fair enough, but quite often it's not. And I love the fact that you have been going through the psalms and doing so many of the psalms. I think this must be one of the healthiest churches in the UK, because you have been engorging and living and breathing the psalms for since January, I think Sammy said. What a fantastic thing to be doing. This is what a wonderful textbook. What a wonderful inspiration to actually being honest with God. And I'm sure it's been mentioned from this very stage over the course of the last few months that David is famously somebody who we should look at his prayer life and we should look at what he wrote, because God himself said, David is a man after my own heart. But I want to put it to you this morning that perhaps one of the reasons that God said that David is a man after my own heart is because David actually went after him. He actually went after him. He didn't let him off the hook. David's communication with God was painfully impolite and honest. He didn't let God off the hook. He absolutely went after him. Is it possible that David was a man after God's own heart because he actually went after him? His complaints were real. And they weren't even small complaints. They were massive complaints. They weren't just saying, oh, God, why didn't you show up? He says, God, why didn't you show up when I needed you most? Why were you invisible at this time when I needed you most? Yet for us, especially as Brits or English people, I think that might be a bit not polite enough for us to actually say that to God. Whereas it would appear that God is big enough to take it. Let's look at the words of the passage. Have you got your Bibles open or is it on the screen? These words, even though we're used to hearing them, these words are not polite words. I cry aloud to the Lord. I cry aloud to the Lord. We missed that out. I cry aloud. He's crying. I lift my voice to the Lord for mercy. I pour out before him my what? Complaint. This is you on the phone to your internet service provider or your mobile phone provider going, excuse me, you said that it was going to arrive on Thursday. It's now Tuesday next week and it hasn't arrived yet. It's that tone of voice. It's complaint. This is not polite. This is a complaint. I pour out my complaint before him. I tell my trouble. When my spirit grows faint within me, it is you who watch over my way. In the path where I walk, people have hidden a snare for me. Look and see, there's no one at my right hand. No one is concerned for me. I have no refuge. No one cares for my life. These are not small things. And you might say, David, you've got all these friends. You've got some soldiers around you. You're exaggerating here slightly. Is it really true that nobody loves you? Yet this is this raw, honest, emotive language. There is no one at my right hand. And he's writing this. Do you remember where he's writing this, as you've just heard? He's in the cave of Adullam. Two other Psalms written here, 34 and 57. It's after 1 Samuel 22 when he's, you know, running away. He's pretended to be a madman. You know, remember that old story, running away from Saul? He's in this cave. So at this point, you could say no one is at his right hand. But you wouldn't say no one is concerned for me. He's got a following. Thousands of people following him. I have no refuge. No one cares for my life. But it would appear that using this emotive, almost hyperbolic language, there is something healthy going on here. There's something healthy in articulating his rage, his anger, his disappointment, his sadness towards God. How often do we feel the freedom to articulate that anger, rage, disappointment, frustration towards God? Or do we think that's something else altogether? We'll create a nice, safe space here where we can all be polite and say nice things to God. That's what coming to church is. But as we think about our young people, these prayers that we've just already heard for our young people who, as Sammy said, are facing so much challenge and facing so many mixed messages. If we don't create a space for our young people especially to articulate their doubt, their questions, their anger, their disappointment towards God, believe me, they will find other ways of expressing that anger and disappointment in ways that will not bless us. So much of our worship, inverted commas, is putting words on a screen, saying, sing these things. And that's great. We should have a canon of worship. We should have an established, strong spine of words, ancient and modern, that articulate the theology of God. But there also has to be space to follow in the footsteps of David and give people space to honestly articulate where they're at. I quite often say to pastors, how do you ever know where your people are at if all you do is tell them what to sing? How do you know where your people are at if all you ever do is tell them what to say? I went on a tour once with my friend Patrick Regan. Some of you may know him. Oh, actually, I saw one of his books, Honestly Before Silence, in the bookshop. We did a tour called When Faith Gets Shaken. And we did, over the course of 3 years, we did 45 things all around the country. And we would often have folks who would come who were in awful situations, who were really struggling with folks with long-term chronic illness, folks, kids who had committed suicide, awful stories, painful stories every night, people whose faith had been utterly shaken. But it was a privilege as we got to know how best to create a space for them to honestly articulate their pain and their rage and their questions before God. And at the end of the night, people would come up and put post-it notes on a cross with all the questions they were wanting to ask God and all the pain they were wanting to bring towards God. And quite often the team, we would then pray with people, and at the end of the night, the team in that area, in that city, in that town, we would stand around the cross, and almost as a healthy bit of debriefing and as a healthy bit of downloading for us, we would pray for each other, and we would pray, and we'd look at what had been written on these post-it notes. And in town after town around the United Kingdom, the church leaders in those places said, I never knew all this stuff was going on with my people. I never knew. We have to create the space where it becomes normal for folks to articulate their pain. And that's why it's so wonderful what you've been led through by Sammy and the team here, in creating this honest space to articulate our pain and our frustrations and our questions to God. And it would appear he is big enough to hear them. And you know the wonderful thing? As we face this mental health epidemic, my wife's a psychotherapist working in the NHS for CAMHS, and I know many of you, some of your kids or grandkids or other friends have been involved with CAMHS, the mental health epidemic amongst teenagers. It is scary. It is unbelievable what is going on, and we have this incredible gift. God gives us this incredible gift. He doesn't expect us to sort it all out in the horizontal. He gives us this incredible opportunity to articulate some of that anxiety, that rage, that sadness, that anger towards him. And the thing that I've discovered in my life, and I don't know if you've discovered it too, but the more that I honestly articulate that anger, that pain, that disappointment, that rage to the vertical, the less of it spews out in the horizontal to my friends and family. I see some people nodding. Because there's a lot bubbling up inside. And if we don't have that port, if we don't have that way of articulating it vertically as God has given us, God knows us. He knows we are designed for surrender, and he is offering us this incredible opportunity to articulate our everything to him, our joy, our sadness, our pain to him. And when we do that, it makes us healthier people in the horizontal, because we're not having to find ways, and we think, oh, we can hold it in. But there will be a moment when somebody just says something and it will spew out. We've all had those experiences with our friends and families and colleagues, don't we? This stuff just doesn't stay inside. It goes out somewhere. It explodes somewhere. I really discovered this myself. It was the Friday, the last day of school in March 2020, which was a pretty significant month in the world. Do you remember that month? And I took my kids for a little picnic. It was the very last day of school before the first lockdown. And I took them out for a little walk up the hill, not knowing how many more walks we would have over the course of the next few months up this hill where we were living in Luton at the time. And we had a picnic, a beautiful picnic. I remember sitting with the kids, having a picnic, thinking, I love these two. Even if the most bizarre thing is about to come upon the world, even if we're not going to make it through this, I am thankful, God, for these two and this beautiful thing. And but then my son, in the way that he does, ran off through this pile of bushes. And I thought, oh, I don't know where he's going. I need to go and go after him. So I went after him. I jumped up and went after him. And my daughter, unbeknownst to me, jumped up and went straight after me. My leg caught a branch, a bramble branch. And she was so close behind me, it flicked back. You know, the branch flicked back. And flicked it forward with my leg and then flicked back. And it caught her in the eye. And long story short, we have to spend that whole weekend in a COVID-infected hospital in Luton because she has a thorn that actually punctured her lens in her left eye as a four-year-old. And so she has to have surgery to save the eye that weekend, and then over the course of the next few months, further surgery. So she now has an artificial lens in that left eye. And it's hard. And it really affects her sight, and it's not fun. And it was an incredible, unbelievable thing. I used to be a doctor myself, and so many of my friends are in the trade, and I was talking to them about it, and they're saying, look, Andy, we see bramble injuries, we see eye injuries like that, you know, once a week probably in casualty, but I have never seen a thorn actually be so specifically straight through the pupil that it actually punctures the lens. Never seen. It's a one in a million happening. Which really got to me because it was very similar to the sort of thing that was said. My son, the day Jesse was born, had a really quite serious stroke, and he's in great shape now. He's recovered really well. A miraculous healing happened. But the same thing was said then, that I thought, that's a one in a million occurrence, what happened with his stroke. And you go, one in a million? God, seriously? A one in a million thing? Just as lockdown starting? Just as we've been having this beautiful moment, having a picnic together? Like, what is that about? What is that about? And Psalm 142, the reason I think I'm probably sharing it with you this morning is that Psalm 142 became my psalm during that whole period of lockdown. I decided, as I was walking along the street one day listening to this scripture, I decided that I was going to tell my trouble to God. I was going to be honest and cry out to him and say, God, why I do not get this? How is this helpful, God? It reminded me of a time, it was 2004, our church was working with a church in Chennai, southeastern coast of India, and we'd had a wonderful day with this beautiful fishing community running around in the sea with them, and these kids were so wonderful. They were so impoverished, though. They didn't have, you know, bodyboards or surfboards or anything like they would have. They had what we called, they just had little bits of plastic they'd found in bins. I called it extreme clipboarding. It was like they were surfing in on these things that were no bigger than a clipboard. We had a wonderful afternoon with these kids, and that was, and we were about to get involved helping that community have better housing, until a month later, we were there in November, and a month later I got a phone call to say that three quarters of that community had been wiped out by the tsunami that ravaged so much of Southeast Asia that Christmas time. And I sat that night looking through the photographs that we'd taken of those beautiful children, going, God, I just don't get this. You know, and I was a kid whose dad was a biology teacher. So I grew up knowing lots about bacteria and viruses, fully understanding that the same bacteria and viruses that cause horrendous illness and disease also do stuff to the leaves and do stuff to other plants that ends up replenishing the soil. So it's all part of the cycle of life, that there's a kind of a circle of life. I understand that the tectonic plates come together. There's a refreshing of the Earth's surface, and that's what happens with the tsunami. I understand that's part of it. I understand, as we just heard in Genesis 1, I understand that when we fail, creation fell alongside us, and therefore things are not as they should be. I get that. I get that innately the world is a fragile place, but I was left saying, God, does it have to be this fragile? Does it really have to be this fragile? And the more people I've met, the more I've realized that that's the cry of so many people. And it might be the cry of you in this room this morning. As you think of the cancer of your wife, husband, mother, father, son, daughter. As you think of the accidents that have happened. As you think of the mental health challenges of the people you know. As we reflect on what's happening in Gaza or Ukraine. We're going, God, we get that it's fragile, but does it have to be this fragile? It's the reason why many of my friends actually don't believe in God. I can't believe in a God of love when there's so much suffering, when things seem to be so out of kilter with how they were designed to be made. These are the words of David. I cry to you, you're my refuge. You are my portion in the land of the living. Listen to my cry, for I am in desperate need. Rescue me from those who pursue me, for they are too strong for me. This is honest expression. This is a David who is looking at the world of 2025 and accurately reporting, as opposed to some of our politeness. They are too strong for me. Why does it have to be this fragile? Sometimes when my friends said to me, Andy, how can you believe in a God of love when you see all this suffering around? And depending on how well I know, or depending on the context, depending on what I've just heard, it may not be appropriate to share this, but there are times when I share this, or there are times when I'm on a radio interview as the token Christian on Five Live, when somebody will say, we'll be talking about suffering, and I'll quite cheekily then ask, and I say, well, I mean, how much would you say your life, give me a percentage, how much would you say your life is aligned with the perfect will of God? And somebody said, well, 0%. I don't believe in God. No, I've no desire to align my life with the will of God. Or if I'm talking to a Christian, they might say, well, I don't know, what would you say? If you had to give it a number, on an average day, what percentage is your life aligned with the perfect will of God? 2% from David there, okay. He's leading us in worship. There's a problem here. Thank you for your honesty, David. I was encouraging honesty. I got it. Great. 2%. Any other numbers on a given day at work? What percentage is your life aligned with the perfect will of God? Five. There you go. Five. Do I hear more than five? Do I hear? Get into an auction. I mean, I would hope on a good day, maybe 30, 40%. But on a bad day, it might be down at, 10, 12%. You know, but I'll say that and somebody will give me their answer. Whether they're a believer or not, well, okay, about that percentage. That's about how much my life's aligned with the perfect will of God. And I say, well, multiply that by 8 billion, and that's the state of the world. You see, it's not much more complicated than that. It's not much more complicated than that. Our God does desire us. He created Eden perfect. But something went wrong. And And that thing is called sin, us slipping out of alignment with his perfect will. That's why the state of the world is the state of the world. And you see, sometimes we mix up the words sovereignty and control when those are two different things. We have a God who has given us free will, incredibly, but that makes him no less sovereign. And sometimes we don't unpack the idea of what sovereignty actually is. There's probably not too many people in this room who would dispute the fact that King Charles is sovereign over this country. I mean, there might be some Republicans in the room, and that's fair enough. But according to our law, according to our country, that King Charles is sovereign over this country. Would you agree? Yeah. Ultimate sovereignty. But we have a police force, and we have laws that are regularly broken. People break the law. Just in Devon yesterday, there must have been 300 or 400 crimes committed that will have been reported to the police. Sovereignty is not the same thing as control. Our God is sovereign over this place. He is utterly sovereign. But I sometimes struggle a bit when we start to talk about our reason for not stressing about things going wrong. Our reason through lockdown, through COVID, through a world war. Sometimes we take this easy answer saying, oh, it's okay, God's in control. Is he? He's definitely sovereign. I absolutely believe him to be sovereign. But he's given us free will. Control's an interesting word, especially in 2025. It's an interesting word. Whether or not it's a helpful word, or whether it's an opt-out word, whether it gives us, like, wow, just, we don't worry. God's in control. Takes the pressure off us. We don't have to be making any ethically good decisions because God's in control. Whereas the more challenging walk is to absolutely acknowledge that he is sovereign. But incredibly, he wants to partner with us. Incredibly, he calls us to be involved in making his beautiful world, in demonstrating the perfection of what that perfect world should look like. Are we going to cry out and say, no, this is not as it should be? Because that is the cry of God. That is the cry of God. To be quiet in the face of the suffering of our lives and in the suffering of our world is to not actually be sitting in the place of the cry of God. If things were not too bad, Jesus would not have had to come. Things are bad. The whole life of Jesus says, folks, this is not that it's not too bad. It's far worse than you think it is. It's 100 times worse than you think it is. And I can see it because I can see inside people's motivations and hearts and minds. You're just looking at what's happening in the external. I'm God. I can see everything that's going on in people's minds. It's a lot worse than you think it is. But there's another story. There's another story. So it's not trying to keep it in this safe middle of saying, oh, things aren't too bad. And our way of getting through the world is saying, oh, it's okay. It's not too bad. It's fine. God's in control. It's saying, no, it's worse than you can possibly imagine. It's a spiritual battle of the armies of light and the armies of darkness. It's full on, but we know the sovereign. And that is what David is doing right here. He's saying, I cry aloud to the Lord. I lift my voice to the Lord for mercy. I pour out before him my complaint. He's in the battle. He's not running away from it to some sort of safe middle class place. I am so prone to suffering avoidance mechanisms where I run away and make sure I live in the nice part of town, in the nice part of the country, and hang out with the nice, not so annoying people to run away from that suffering rather than being present in the midst of it. Doing what Jesus did, taking the place, the incarnation of stepping into a broken world. Stepping into a broken place. Have you done Psalm 22 on your way through the Psalms? Can you? Oh, gosh. Can anybody? Yes, we have. Sammy says yes. Sorry. Lord, I bring you Sammy's discouragement right now. Sammy, that's for your prayers for later. But, you know, my God, why have you forsaken me? You know, if we need any encouragement that following the way of David is the way our prayer life and our interaction with God should be, if we need any encouragement in that, surely Psalm 22 screams it loud, because Jesus himself, even though he was perfect, chose to cry out in pain, chose to cry at Lazarus' death, chose to cry in the Garden of Gethsemane, chose to cry out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's God. And he's crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? So why would we fight shy of that honest language to say to God, God, this is terrible. This is shocking. And I honestly believe our relationship with God and our relationship with each other would be healthier if we could be honest and to properly frame what we see in our own hearts and our minds, what we see ourselves thinking and what we see on our TVs and we see on our phones. You see, sometimes the cave that David is sitting in here, the cave, this place of solo connection, sometimes that's the problem. Sometimes we get so lost in these devices. These become caves. These phones become our caves. So we're antiseptically just sort of treating ourselves, going to information and distraction and novelty rather than doing the harder yards of first turning to him. Because when we get into that middle class place of suffering avoidance, usually prayer is something that's just a last resort. That's the problem. When we have pulled all our levers of resource of the NHS, our private health care, or something else, or getting our other people to help, or sorting something out, getting a gift, when we've gone through all those efforts, all those levers we can pull, then, gosh, there's nothing left to do but pray. When prayer is meant to be our first port of call, rather than our last resort. That's what David is showing here. I cry aloud to the Lord. I lift my voice. I pour out before him my complaint. Before him I tell my trouble. First port of call, not last resort, when all human efforts have been tried out. Before him I tell my trouble. You know, I wonder if David came to visit, King David the psalmist came to visit some of our churches today, would he be going, folks, I'm really honored and impressed that you're still singing my stuff. But I want you to follow what I did, not just follow my words. I want it to be an example. I think that's why they put me in the Bible. I want it to be an example. So when I was writing things down, you're still singing about my sheep, and you're still singing about my lions, and you're still singing about my battles, but like you've got blocks of flats and mobile phones and wheelie bins. Is that not what you should be writing about? Should you not be articulating your honest 2025 stuff to God? That's the example I'm trying to give you. I mean, it's really lovely that you're still singing about my sheep. You know? It's really lovely. It's lovely that you're saying the Lord is like a strong tower, but I suspect in 2025, none of you have run away from any Vikings recently to the top of a strong tower. I love that your kids are singing, give me oil in my lamp, keep me burning, but not too many of them are coming home later that night and actually putting oil in their lamps. So they don't fully understand. They can't step into the metaphor. We're called to use the stuff of here and now to be the metaphor and the words and the honesty of our expression to God in 2025 right here. Yet so often we are hiding away in religious language. Now it's good, as I said before, we need that spine, we need the vertebra of words that have been around for hundreds of years, so we're not just singing superficial, subjective nonsense schmush, which a lot of modern worship is, let's face it. It's really good. It's really, really good to have the ancient. It's really good to have the stuff that's lasted for generations. But that's the spine that we need. But we also need the limbs to be able to go, actually, God, I need you to move right now. I need you to move right now. I need you to, I want you. I want to be so connected to you. I want like it to be like five bars on my phone. Thank you that you're like that. I want you to be, you're maybe not like a strong tar. You're a bouncer outside my nightclub to stop that stuff getting in my. We need to be using the language of now. As John Bell, the theologian, says, if we're not singing about God in the kitchen, it's unlikely we're going to be looking out for him in the kitchen. David sang about the stuff that was right in front of him. Could we write about what's right in front of us? And that is why you've got a piece of paper. Because we're not just going to keep it in our heads as a little idea this morning. I'm hoping that some of the stuff that I've shared will have sparked a few thoughts, will have sparked a few emotions, will have sparked a few cries, will have sparked a few questions. I would love it if we could make our connection with God real and personal this morning. Not somebody else's words. That's a second-hand relationship. If all we ever do is communicate with God using words that somebody else has written on a screen, that's a second-hand relationship with God you've got, not a first-hand relationship with God. That's being a consumer. That's Sammy being your Sammy and David being your religious services provider. That's somebody who you might want to make a complaint about on the phone, like your internet services provider. Do you know what I mean? But we become consumers of somebody else's religious service provision rather than actually taking the responsibility to do what David did and honestly use the metaphor and image and experiences of his day and his week to come before God in absolute honesty. I wonder, could we bring our anxiety, could we bring our suffering, could we bring our happiness to God right now in a little psalm, just a little paragraph that would honestly articulate everything about your emotional state and everything about your week to this point. Would you be up for doing that now? So we've got 5 minutes now. We've got 5 minutes. And if you don't have a pen, can you put your hand up and Sammy will bring you one? But you should all have a piece of paper. So can I just encourage us, David needs one as well there. Can I just encourage us that useful questions in and around when you're writing your own little paragraph of a psalm like this, are questions like why? Are questions like who? And questions like how? Sometimes our best prayers to God, our most honest prayers to God are questions. So this might not be about you having the answers or just complaining. This might be an absolute complaint, but it might be a question that says, God, why was it? Why is it that this has happened now? Why is it we've got we're back to the hospital for the third time this year? Why is it? I know we're not going to be without suffering, but this is just a bit much. What could you honestly express about your family, about your life, about the world? God, why is there such a lack of truth out there? Why is there so much misinformation online? Why can't you put a stop to that? I know you could put a stop to that stuff. I know you could silence the liars. Why don't you? For each of us, it'll be different. It'll be different things. Right, I'm going to be quiet myself and allow you to do that for 5 minutes. Lord, lead us, I pray. Give us a spirit of honesty and a spirit of truth. In Jesus' name, amen.